At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm Nick Wallace. This is reporting Depp v. Heard. Regular updates from the court in the celebrity trial of the century.
Hello and welcome to another reporting Depp v. Heard. As you know, we reached the end of week four of the trial last Friday. Court isn't sitting this week because Judge Penny Azcarate has a conference that she has to go to. So I am spending this week doing a little bit of sightseeing, a little bit of work, and of course collecting some more remote park bench interviews for you. In this episode, we're going to hear from Professor Kurt Gray, who is Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. He specializes in how human beings make moral judgments, and he has come to be quite interested in this case. We're going to hear from Krista, who is a Director of Operations for a large financial services company, or at least was before she moved into the consulting role. And while she's been transitioning, she's been taking a very keen interest in Depp v. Heard. And finally, we'll hear from Dr. Charlotte Proudman, a barrister and expert in violence against women and girls, as well as being a fellow of Queen's College, Cambridge. So I kicked off by asking Professor Kurt Gray just why Depp v. Heard has interested him so much.
This trial is incredibly interesting to me because we've got two parties, both of whom say the other party is incredibly evil. It's divided many people in America and even the world about who is evil and who isn't. And so that's obviously why I find it so interesting, because it's the perfect kind of demonstration, applied example of my research. So I study the perception of morality, so how people make their moral judgments. And so I'm mostly interested in kind of everyday people's judgments of what's going on in the courtroom. But obviously, you know, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard are also people who are making judgments of the others and their lawyers, right? We're all kind of united in some sense by the fact that we see the moral world in a certain way. And we are trying to convince others that our way of seeing the world is right and the other way of seeing it is wrong. That's the interesting thing about morality, right? Even if there's gray areas, it never seems that way. It seems like it's black and white.
So when we dig down into this, I mean, one of the things that many people are perhaps finding surprising is the support that Johnny Depp has taken on huge levels. It's taken over social media, and these are people who come at this from many, many different angles. You have people within the men's rights movement who are saying that this is an opportunity to finally nail the lie that women can't be abusers. This is women who've been abused and say, I recognize patterns of abuse in the way that Amber Heard is presenting herself or has presented herself, or the evidence that the contemporaneous evidence that exists. And obviously you have the fans who believe their man can do no wrong. And you've obviously got the pushback, which is coming from, let's say, the more traditionally feminist areas, saying, well, this is Johnny Depp. He's showing the patterns of behavior of an abuser. And if there isn't any evidence, actual documentary evidence of him being abusive, or at least violently abusive, that doesn't mean that he isn't guilty of the things that Amber Heard is very graphically accusing him of. So how do you start to pick this apart from an intellectual and academic standpoint?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's so messy. And I think this is why it's such an interesting case, intellectually speaking, right? Because when we think about abuse, we have an image that comes to mind. And it's usually, you know, the big drunken man who comes home and abuses his wife, right? Who's much smaller than him, much meeker, unable to fight back. And there we kind of divide that moral situation into the kind of clear victimizer and the clear victim. And it turns out that's our understanding of the moral world in general. If you think of any kind of moral act like murder, like abuse, theft, it doesn't matter. You always think of someone who's a pure victimizer and a pure victim. And many things fit that. but not all things. And so the reason that this case is so impassioned on both sides is because that narrative kind of falls apart, right? Because it's not clear if Amber Heard is a pure victim or a little bit of victimizer, and it's not clear if Johnny Depp is just a pure victimizer, a little bit victim, or reverse, right? It's complicated. And so anytime that there's gray areas in the kind of pairing with an immoral deed, right? You're not clear who the victimizer and who the victim is. Well, people don't like gray areas in morality, right? We want to draw a firm line in the sand. And so what has to happen is you have to pick one person, and I'm not saying you have to, but I'm saying that's how the mind kind of simplifies these things. People pick, this is the victimizer, 100%, this is the victim, 100%, right? And so the fact that there's a little bit of wiggle room now means that one person's victim is the other person's victimizer, and then, right, there's no room for agreement. There's no room for agreement at all.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that one doctor gave her assessment of their relationship as mutual abuse. And I picked that out as something that I thought was significant from that day's evidence. And the opprobrium that was rained down on me came from many people who said that mutual abuse is a discredited phrase. There is an abuser who may well accuse their victim of being equally abusive, but that's a form of gaslighting and that's a form of muddying the waters. And so the idea that there is absolutism in this, black and white in this, is kind of baked into the system, kind of baked into our value judgments, and also baked into the law. I mean, the jury is being asked to pick a side, aren't they? That is our way of resolving disputes in an adversarial system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point. And it's baked into those systems because it's baked into the way our mind works. Right? Our mind works into, right? Like there's a reason that we have a field for criminology and then a whole separate field for victimology, right? And different scholars in each of those fields, because when we study and we think about the world, we only think of, well, there's like criminals and there's the people they harm. And so I was gonna say, I like the fact that you got all this pushback about the phrase mutual abuse. And I don't like the fact that you got rained on, but I think it really does illustrate how we split the world into these two camps. And the phrase that we use in my research is moral typecasting. So, and it's kind of, right, these are actors and actresses, right? And so they're often, like Johnny Depp is typecast as the kind of like silly Captain Jack, right? And it turns that we typecast people in morality as well. We see them as you have to be the villain or you have to be the victim, and it's hard to see them as any other way. So the classic example of typecasting is Leonard Nimoy as Spock, right? It's hard to imagine Spock as the kind of fun-loving uncle, right, who likes to giggle. But of course, you know, if you know the man of Leonard Nimoy when he was alive, he was fun-loving. But when someone's in these roles, we can't see them as something else. And so we typecast depending on your political beliefs, right, your values. You either typecast Heard as the kind of gaslighter who's pretending to cry on the stand, or Depp as the gaslighter, the villain who's like smirking during the testimony because he knows he's, right, oppressed Amber. And so, right, each of these ways of defying or kind of like defying the idea of mutual abuse happens on either side, right? Because you have to support your narrative and destroy the other.
And that's the extraordinary thing about this case, is that you have two diametrically opposed narratives, which both sides are not just clinging to, but they're amplifying and amplifying with every day of court that goes by. Johnny Depp's is that he never laid a finger on Amber Heard. Amber Heard's is that he beat her up in some of the most horrendous ways possible over a sustained period of time. So where do we go from here? Because they are in an adversarial court system. They have people either side of them who are Team Depp, Team Heard, who are gunning for each other in pretty horrendous ways online and in mainstream media. As an academic who's studied this, what's the solution? How do we start picking this apart? How do we start to understand what may have gone on here in a way that is more rational?
I mean, I think it comes down to the assessment of, well, let's think there's two things that we need to understand when we consider kind of moral situations. So one is blame, and the other is pain, right? And so we think of victimizers, villains, we blame them. And we think of victims, we think of pain, right? And how our mind splits the world is we think that if you're blameworthy, then you can't suffer at all. And if you're suffering, then you can't be blamed at all. This is why in court cases, the best way to escape blame is by emphasizing your own pain, right? Because we see them as diametrically opposed. And so I think what we need to do to kind of like begin to make sense of this complicated scenario is kind of run from this idea of moral typecasting a little bit, even though it's baked into our minds. We can understand that someone can be blameworthy and still have suffered. And we can understand that someone who may have suffered real suffering can still be blameworthy. But then once you kind of admit these things, well, then it's no longer black and white. And as you mentioned, right, the jury has to make a call one way or the other, right? Is it defamation? Is it justifiable? And so for those cases, you know, I'm not in the courtroom, I'm not sitting in the jury, it's hard for me to know, but what I do know is that the sides that represent Depp and Heard aren't as correct as they think they are. It's not 100%, right? We're really arguing maybe about, I don't want to say the numbers, but it's not 100% or 0%, right? And I think once we understand that ambiguity, we can be a little humbler when we're arguing, even if there's a kind of fact of the matter, what did happen in their relationship.
Do you have a preferred model for this going forward? Because you're talking about this is just the way our minds are set up. This is the way. Is this something that Western society, for instance, has created, this kind of model of pain and blame or victim and oppressor? Are there other models that we should be looking at? Because as you say, it's so baked into our way of thinking and our morality and our judicial system and the way that we operate, even sort of between the sexes. Is there an alternative, or is that, or we just got to work out ways to navigate it and understand it and then deal with it that way?
I think there are probably some alternatives. And I think you're right that in the West, we emphasize kind of dualities more, right? That you have to be, you know, one or the other. You have to be, right, pick something, right? You have to pick a role. You have to, you know, pick a place in society. But I think it's kind of a human universal. So if you think of like the, you know, yin yang, the kind of duality between light and dark, right? That duality comes from Eastern thought. And so one way of escaping it is to say, look, we're all a little to blame, right? We're all guilty of having a toxic relationship. But at the end of the day, when you're fighting over, you know, what's defamation and down the road, kind of like civil penalties, then I don't know if we can be, you know, fully agnostic about it. I think that this idea of kind of like there's a person who harms and a person who receives the harm, it is baked in because that's just the way our language and our thoughts work. If you think of language like, she gave Spot the ball, right? You know, she is the one who's doing it and Spot is the one who's getting the ball. Why we always have, even in our simplest sentences, the kind of agent who's doing something and the kind of recipient who's the target of the action. And so it's hard for our minds to escape this fundamental idea of like one person does something to another. But I don't think it's impossible. And it's certainly when, you know, there's no reason to scream at the other side outside the courtroom for not believing with your preferred narrative.
Does that mean that we don't necessarily even have the language to parse the truth in a situation like this? Because of course, you know, the legal system is forcing both sides apart in order to get a result on one side or another. And again, that goes back to the adversarial thing. But it sounds as if we don't even necessarily have the right language to talk about what goes on in intimate relationships, especially ones that turn toxic.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a great question about how much our language and our concepts structure our thought and ultimately structure our society. And I think, I don't want to be too deterministic about our language, but it is powerful, right? It is powerful. And the way we understand the kind of moral world through our language and through the ideas that have been with us for thousands of years means that it's not easy to blame both people. It's not easy to see both people as being victimized, as both people just, you know, being not great relationship partners. But I think one way of doing it is to kind of remove it from a moral framework if you can. So a moral framework always has the kind of oppressor and oppressed, or victimizer and victim. But you can't imagine a kind of just two people not being very good friends to each other, right? You can imagine two people in a relationship just like both not being especially kind or especially thoughtful. And of course, when there's abuse involved, it's clearly moral. But if we can step back and say, well, they're both people who you probably wouldn't want to be in a relationship with, right? They're both not great partners. And maybe that gives you a kind of a little humility in thinking about the kind of complexity of the moral situation.
So we could go into amoral violence, perhaps.
Or at least amoral relationship behavior, right? Maybe they're both bad at intimacy. Maybe they both had weird childhoods. There's a saying, is to explain to condone. And it's often targeted at social psychologists, right? When we try to make sense of the atrocities of the world or the violence that people endure, and we try to think, well, let's think about why someone would be so evil, right? Let's think about why someone might want to cause, you know, genocide in the largest case. And I'm certainly not an apologist for violence. And I don't think, you know, I think abuse is terrible, right? But there is something, as being an academic, you try to like look at these problems and you try to think through them, right? Think of the mechanisms of actually what's going on, almost like a jury in a courtroom, right? But ultimately, what I'm trying to do isn't to figure who's ultimately to blame, but to understand how people might be willing to do this, or in the case of this trial, how we might see this in such a black and white way.
My thanks to Professor Kirk Gray for his time. So the next Remote Park Bench interview is with Krista, who styles herself on Instagram and Twitter as @thatcurious_cat in both cases. She's taken an interest in this trial whilst she's been moving from her previous job in a financial services company in Canada to starting to consult in leadership roles. And so some of the imaging and messaging that she's been seeing coming out of the trial has gripped her, and she's come to certain conclusions about it. This is what she had to say.
I think with anything in life, when it comes to people, especially when you're talking about strong emotions, you can feel what they're feeling. For the most part, any person that has any modicum of empathy, especially on such a difficult subject, you know, when I was watching Johnny speak, you could feel what he was saying. I didn't feel anything with Amber. I found it inauthentic. I found it put on a little bit, over exaggerated a little bit, which I really struggled with. And to be honest, obviously I'm a woman. I don't want to believe a woman when they come forward with such allegations. And these were heinous allegations that she's saying. So
lengthy, you know, detailed, and yeah, over a long period of time.
Right. So you don't want to, your first inclination is to want to believe when somebody says these things. And I just, I didn't find them credible. The inconsistencies that were being said throughout the story, but there was perfect detail that was thrown in that almost felt contrived, but yet lack of. So I struggle also when you think about, she's a very good documenter. So she'll take photos of Johnny sleeping or of bottles being thrown over, but she won't take pictures of her sliced up feet or her, right? So there's a lot of things that that I find just don't make sense to me.
Let's talk a little bit about the people who are taking an interest in this
yes.
trial. I've spoken to an awful lot of people who have their own difficult histories, and they've either been abused or they have a connection to the themes that are running yeah. through this trial in some way. And they are recognizing and seeing patterns that perhaps
yes.
people who've never been in that situation aren't seeing. Both
Absolutely.
Johnny Depp and Amber Heard clearly had difficult and abusive childhoods. I think
yes.
that's now on the record yeah. for both parties. Do you have any sort of special insight or empathy with that side of things at all?
I do, absolutely. I'm one of those. So I unfortunately had a very tumultuous childhood myself. That in my adult years, I leaned on a lot of therapy to get me through it. So I can recognize a lot of those signs, outside of a tumultuous childhood, when I grew up, my first relationship ended up being abusive. So which tends to be statistically the direction that children that are abused end up in those relationships down the road. So I have a lot of experience with that myself. You know, and there was one thing that I thought of immediately when, sorry, I'm going to digress just a little bit, but it's in the same area.
It's fascinating.
When these allegations first came out in 2016, you know, the Me Too movement was on the rise. And of course, the Me Too movement was necessary. It happened for a reason. It was necessary. But I think, you know, like with any social movements in life or any large, it's just go big or go home all the way, that we perhaps lost sight of, you know, listen and hear and perhaps investigate rather than listen and hear, believe right away. If it turns out that Amber is making this up, if this was all a vendetta, you know, revenge, she was angry, whatever, to get more money, whatever it was, if it turns out that that's the truth, regardless of my beliefs, you know, where I believe, where I sit on that, it's going to make it all the more difficult for victims to come forward and be believed, especially women. I can almost foresee it. The writing is on the wall. I can almost foresee the number of lawyers that are representing male abusers bringing this up.
It's really interesting you say that, because I've heard that from so many different perspectives over the course of the last 4 weeks. And yet you're also hearing on the other side of the argument, the Johnny Depp is got all the patterns of an abuser, jealous behavior, which he's admitted to, the smashing up of things, which I know is contentious. People say that you can smash inanimate objects and not be abused, and I can
absolutely
get that.
Yep.
But you can also smash things up and be an abuser and
course,
be threatening
yeah.
to be around.
Of course.
And so you've got people saying, well, this is him continuing the abuse by other means. She dared raise her hand as a victim, and now he is going after her to publicly humiliate her, put her on the stand and talk about her experiences of being sexually abused so that the whole world can hate on her and not just
him. Well, it's an angle. It's an angle for sure. I mean, I think the past, what year are we in? 2022, this started in 2016. I think the past 6 years have shown us firsthand that Amber was believed. She was believed wholeheartedly. Johnny's career was essentially ended. So that argument, it's an angle that I think is a bit of a stretch, because Amber was wholeheartedly backed and supported and believed, and to the point where the big guys and Disney and Warner Brothers separated themselves, regardless of any supporting proof, you know, to corroborate the allegations. She was wholeheartedly believed. So I think that almost, it does the opposite for me. If you fast forward 6 years later and he's finally standing up and saying, hang about, please, let's look at this a little bit. It actually leans more the other way for me.
You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at traceminerals.com.
Thank you to Krista for getting in touch and offering her contribution. So the final remote park bench interview of this bonus episode is with Dr. Charlotte Proudman, a barrister and an expert in violence against women and girls. She wrote an article in a UK-based paper called The Independent saying that she thought Johnny Depp was an abuser. I started by asking if she was aware of the stir that article had caused on social media.
There was a lot of positivity. In fact, I'd say as soon as I received a positive response, such as emails often from survivors or a positive comment, I'd instantly get something very negative sent straight back to me. Very vitriolic, nasty, misogynist, vile comments. So it was a very sort of polarized response from one side to the other.
What's your view of what is going on in the online world surrounding this trial? Because I think there is an established acceptance that Johnny Depp and his supporters have seized the narrative in social media, and traditional media are taking its cues from there. They are seeing that there appears to be a huge groundswell of support in America and around the world for Johnny Depp. and that this is taking control of where the narrative is going, and therefore that's serving his purposes. That's essentially what he fought to do, to get this trial heard in public, so that he could, in his words, tell his side of the story.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it, how social media seems to have influenced mainstream newspapers and media outlets. And, you know, there's definitely an enormous swell on social media, which is highly supportive of Johnny Depp. And I do wonder how many of these accounts, and I'm talking about thousands of accounts, are actually genuine, real people, or whether they are bots. Because
why do you say that?
Because I look at some of the accounts, and they have his name as a handle, they have his photograph, and the entirety of their comments, their likes, etc., it's just on Johnny Depp. And they're clearly just targeting anyone that mentions Depp, Johnny, Heard, Amber, in different ways in which they're writing that, or even trial. And then they're targeting anyone that comments positively in support of Amber Heard.
Well, I've spent a lot of time at the trial, and in doing that have met a lot of the social media influencers, many of whom are queuing up from the early hours to get into court. They go and make their content. And many of the people who are very powerful on Twitter, I can promise you that they're very much not bots. And also a huge number, an overwhelming number of people who I've met who support Johnny Depp in person are women, particularly women who've been abused. And they say they see Amber Heard, the patterns of abuse that they saw in their abuser as well. And this is their lived reality. So they see Amber Heard as a fantasist and a liar. And they want to use this trial as an opportunity to not just call her out as they see it, but also to call out any other women who might be attempted to try and manipulate the system, or manipulate a relationship, or manipulate the legal process by faking what happened to them in their relationship.
Well, I think that's a very dangerous, warped approach to take to this particular case, because Johnny Depp was found to be an abuser of Amber Heard in a high court trial that took place in London. Very serious allegations that were made by Amber Heard, and the vast majority of them proved following a very lengthy high court trial. I remember actually being at the high court during that trial. I was doing a completely different case, but I saw him pretty much every day, and we walked past each other, we walked through security together. He would smile, and he would see his fans outside of court waiting all day with banners, blowing kisses at him, throwing roses at him. And you're right, many of those were women. But, you know, just because they are women, it doesn't necessarily, I think, send out a strong message that there isn't a swell of support also for Amber Heard. There are lots of victims of domestic abuse, perhaps more of the silent majority, that are looking at this, that see themselves in Amber Heard and feel that they have been silenced. And they see the memes, the laughter, the jokes that are made about Amber Heard when she's giving evidence. And I think as a result of that, many will be worried and scared about coming forward. And that's my concern, the repercussions and reverberations that this is going to have on other victims of domestic abuse and potentially other trials in the future, not just including vulnerable, marginalized women, you know, who I represent, but also those that are in relationships with rich and powerful individuals that are worried they're going to be held up to this very high standard and scrutinized in this very misogynistic, visceral, graphic, intimate way, where every part of her body is objectified and every single move she makes is watched under a microscope.
There's a lot to unpack in that answer. I'll try a couple of areas. Are you not denying the lived experience then of the women who say, look, I've been in an abusive relationship. I've stood in the queue with people who've shown me photos of what their partner has done to them. And they say nothing in what Amber Heard is saying rings true. Well, let's just address that particular area first, because you're essentially just dismissing that, are you?
I am dismissing that. I think that if that's their opinion, of course, they're entitled to have that opinion. I don't agree with it. So I dismiss it to that extent that I don't agree with that opinion.
And what is it that you don't agree? Do you disagree with they can understand what they see in Amber Heard as reflecting what they experienced in their relationship? Or are you just dismissing what they're saying?
I think that Amber Heard is a victim of domestic abuse. And it's not just me that thinks that. A high court judge thinks that, who did over 100-page judgment along with the Court of Appeal that dismissed his appeal. Why are they disagreeing with a high court judge and a Court of Appeal judges?
Given we are where we are, And you can imagine how the American media will spend no time dismissing the decisions of a single English judge if the verdict goes in Johnny Depp's favour. What do you see about the way this has gone? I know we've had the vast majority of Johnny Depp's evidence, and of course you would be expecting Amber Heard to have a number of witnesses who are in a position to at least make a strong case for her. But I've spoken to attorneys, very learned people over here in the States, who say that the reverberations from this trial will echo throughout American culture for decades to come.
No, I think that's right. It absolutely will. I think really, regardless of which way it goes, whether they find in Amber Heard's favour and they find the allegations proved, or they go in Johnny Depp's favour, I think that ultimately the trial has come down to social media and to the reports that are in the press, which is largely favourable to Johnny Depp. And if you look, for example, at the fact that Amber Heard was found to be a victim in the High Court in London, I hear what you say about that. But regardless of the decision that was made, it's put to one side. And then there is a lot of minimization around that judgment. While it was just a single judge that made that decision, it's on the balance of probabilities. All these types of minimization arguments suggest that that decision is somehow not credible, and the legitimacy of it is undermined. And the same thing would happen, I think, in this trial, if indeed a similar decision was made and Amber Heard was found to be a victim. People just won't believe it. They won't rely upon it. So what is the point then in going through the legal system if ultimately people are going to judge it on their own decision, their own opinions, and on the basis of what's written on social media? It just effectively becomes a show trial. And the question is, do you believe in the justice system? Do you believe in the integrity of it? Are you willing to put your faith in it? Clearly Amber Heard has, in the sense that she's countersued, as it seems, for $100 million on the basis of the harm that she says that she has suffered. But it's going to have an enormous impact, I think, upon the way in which victims of domestic abuse are treated within the legal system, believe that they're going to be treated after watching this play out in the public eye.
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of questions about the weaknesses of the legal system for deciding situations like this. But it comes back to the case that it's about the only thing that we've got. I mean, Johnny Depp took this legal action, he says, because it was the only way that he had of clearing his name. And rather than, you know, as many other people have said, because it's another way of gaslighting and continuing to victimise his victim.
Wow. I mean, just on that point, I mean, in my view, going through a second trial is a form of post-separation coercive and controlling behavior. He's not accepting the decision.
But how else does he get to clear his name as if he believes he's innocent?
Well, he's clearly been found not to be innocent, hasn't he? And he hasn't, you know, hasn't done any rehabilitation, any form of reform. What are we going to do? Just have forum shopping? Just go to a different jurisdiction and, you know, have another case? What is he going to do if he loses this case? Is there going to be another trial in a different jurisdiction?
His point that the judge accepted, because of course Amber Heard's legal team tried to make this point, but his point, as the judge accepted, was that Amber Heard was not the defendant in the first trial, and therefore he wasn't able to get level of disclosure and discovery.
She was the key witness, wasn't she, in the first trial in London? So she was the one that had to give witness for a significantly long period of time, no doubt experiencing re-victimization, re-traumatization, a lot of triggering. It's said that she suffers with PTS as well. And then having to go through a second trial with the media, the whole world judging her as a result of that, as well as also suing her for $50 million, screams out to me, and no doubt to many other people, as an opinion, that it could look like a form of financial control. Sure. Of course, we have to wait to see the outcome, but that's how it appears.
But what fascinates me is that you are absolutely convinced he is an abuser. There are many, many hundreds of women who are absolutely convinced he isn't an abuser. And no one really knows, because we weren't there. We didn't, well, we weren't
say
behind
that with
closed
every
doors.
But you can say that.
Well, this is the thing.
Every single rape and domestic abuse case, and that's the point. But we don't say it when it comes to terrorism. We don't say when it comes to mugging or theft. We don't say, oh, well, we were not there, so we're not quite sure what happened. We accept what a complainant often says, don't we? It's scrutinized to an extent, but not to the extent that gender-based violence is, because there's this perception that a woman is likely to lie. And yet the evidence shows it's only around in 3% of cases that women lie about rape for a whole variety of reasons.
And the point that everyone is making here, that this is one of those 3% cases, that Amber Heard is being manipulative, Amber Heard is making things up, she's a fantasist, she's acting on the stand, and this on the basis of what people say they've been looking at, and you know, there are people who have gone into far more evidence and seen far more detail of this than the jury in this case ever will, because of what's been published and made admissible by the parties and the judge. They have come to their conclusion and they are outraged that people like you can call this from where you're sitting, when they say, no, we've done the research, we've lived this experience, we know what we're talking about, she's a liar.
Well, I find it outrageous that people want to go behind a decision of a high court judge in London and appear to take no credence in that whatsoever, which shows that they don't clearly have any faith in the justice system, otherwise they'd accept that, wouldn't they? I mean, the kind of way in which they're picking it apart is fairly appalling. I don't accept that Amber Heard comes across someone who is manipulative or a liar in this way. And my concern is that the focus on her and these kind of gender tropes and stereotypes means that he is rendered invisible.
The humour element of this, I find it hilarious that Amber Heard's fans are saying this, that and the other, and the humorous memes and the Mickey taking TikToks and things like that. Humour as a weapon to bully people, I find is a really interesting phenomenon. It's not just all out vitriol. It's that kind of like, oh yeah, we're all laughing along with Johnny Depp supporters online pointing out the inconsistencies in Amber Heard's evidence. That to me strikes me as a slightly new thing.
I mean, obviously I can only speak in terms of seeing the court cases where, you know, they're not put on trial in terms of the whole world watching them. But from what I see within these court cases, often, yeah, humour is used. I do often see perpetrators smirk at their victims, smile, even sometimes laugh. And in some cases, there have been no screens in place, and then I've been successful on appeal in saying that victims haven't been able to give their best evidence as a result of that, which is what we're seeing with Amber Heard. She's giving evidence looking at her allegedly abuser in the US and, of course, found abuser.
And
in
he's laughing at her.
But
his supporters would say that he's laughing at her because it is so ridiculous what she's saying. And, you know, you can't help yourself.
I think that's shameful. Where's the compassion? Where's the kindness? This woman is on trial, regardless of what he thinks he did or didn't do to her. This is a human being which is clearly struggling enormously and experiencing a lot of distress. I mean, it's absolutely an appalling indictment. It really is of humanity that we've come this far, that we're laughing at complainants of sexual violence in court, and we think that that is acceptable. Is that really the standard of our society? Is that really how we're going to treat complainants of sexual assault?
Thank you very much to all my guests who contributed to this bonus episode. I've spent the week buried in an article which I'm meant to be writing, procrastinating, I think is the exact word, rather than buried, and visiting a few of the amazing museums that we have here in Washington, D.C., which is where my apartment is. Next week, I will be traveling back to Virginia, Fairfax County Court, to pick up the final 2 weeks of Depp v. Heard. It will be starting at 9 a.m. every day. You can follow it live on various YouTube channels. It's being streamed. I will also try to do some live tweeting, depending on my various media commitments. But I will also be updating the podcast on a daily basis once we go back to work. Monday to Thursday next week, then Monday to Friday the following week. And then it's a question of sitting around and waiting for the jury to come up with a verdict. If you would like to make sure that these episodes of Reporting Depp v. Heard are delivered into your inbox whenever they are made, simply follow and subscribe to the podcast on whatever your chosen podcast delivery platform is. Thank you very much again for listening. Take care.
I'm Nick Wallace. This is Reporting Depp v. Heard.